Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today grew up in Zambia and has worked in Britain, Zimbabwe and Canada. She lives in London, where she's a senior research fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, School of Advanced Study, University of London. She's published widely on Africa, decolonisation and the global power shifts of the 20th century. Susan Williams, welcome to Meet the Writers. Now, you have a long list of publications to your name, but it's your books on the Congo that I really want to talk about today because, well, they completely changed my worldview. It's very rare, I think, to find an academic who can write as compellingly about serious subjects in such an accessible and exciting way. And you've managed that in these books. They are really extraordinary pieces of work. And I'm very keen to introduce them to people. I'm often asked during this programme, what are my favourite books? Who are the authors I've met that have really inspired me? And I think that your books actually answer that question. So thank you so much for coming in.
I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start with Who Killed Dag Hammarskjöld. First, tell us who he was.
Well, Hammarskjöld was the second UN Secretary General who took up his post in 1953. He was a patrician Swede whose father had been Prime Minister for a while, Governor of Uppsala province. He grew up in a castle with turrets, very much a refined, elegant, as I say, patrician background. He was also quite brilliant. He had a PhD. He became a civil servant in Sweden. He contributed to the setting up of the Swedish civil service with his brother. And when he was selected for the post of UN Secretary General.
Only the second in its history.
Absolutely. Yeah. As far as we can see, the feeling of certainly the Western powers was that he would be fairly tame and he would do what they wanted. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. Very swiftly, he showed that his allegiance was to the UN Charter and to the needs of the nations that he was responsible for.
Mm-hmm. Now, decolonisation was one of the things that he was very keen on. And that was one of the reasons that he went to the Congo in the early 60s. Tell us what he was doing on that particular trip in 1961.
When Hammarskjöld arrived in the Congo in 1961, it was a time of real crisis in Congo, especially in relation to Katanga, where effectively a war was going on between the seceded Katangan province, which was being supported by not just the colonial powers, but a whole range of mercenaries.
Who were there because they were interested in the mineral wealth of the province.
Absolutely right, yes. And the UN forces who were there to try and keep the peace and to further the UN's commitment to a federal Congo. And at that time, it was said that it looked as if this was going to become a third world war.
So Hammarskjöld was essentially there to bring peace. And in order to do so, he went off by plane to have a meeting in Ndola in Zambia with many of the key players who were involved in that peace process. He never made it. Tell us what happened that night.
It appears that the plane crashed shortly after midnight, not far from Ndola Airport, where it was expected to land, leading to the death of Hammarskjöld and the 15 other people who were on the plane, the UN mission, including the Swedish crew. Only one survived. Well, this is all, we don't have the details of this, but we do know for a fact that one person survived. And this person said that before the plane crashed, there were sparks in the sky and that the plane blew up. This man, who was an American veteran of the Korean War, ended up going to hospital and dying a few days later.
And he really shouldn't have. I mean, he wasn't that ill. It looked like he was going to pull through, didn't it?
It certainly did. It was surprising that he died, given the nature of his injuries.
Mm. Let's now look at the crash site, because there are so many things that just don't add up about that. So, for instance, Hammarskjöld's body was found some way away from the others. He was the only one who wasn't completely burned.
Yes, and when I saw the photographs of the crash victims in the archives that are held at the University of Oxford, I was astonished to see how completely free of any kind of charring he was, because the other victims were, well, they were burnt so badly that some of them could only be identified through dental records. Mm. In addition, you can see very clearly in the photographs of Hammarskjöld, there's a playing card stuck in his neck. And there are other very odd manifestations in the photographs which suggest very strongly, photoshopping, I think is the word that's used now, so that the one part of the right side of his face is just become fuzzy.
And there are suggestions that, of course, that was a gunshot to the head.
Yeah.
So all of this is pointing to something nefarious. Something happened there. And there's more and more evidence coming out that that, in fact, is true. So the question is, what happened and who made it happen?
Well, I think another important point is that a number of witnesses of what happened that night, many witnesses, were not believed. Zambian witnesses in the British colony of Northern Rhodesia, which was very much white minority ruled state, apartheid in all but name, which meant that the majority population really had no voice and were treated extremely badly. And there was a township of Zambians living in this segregated township not far from the crash site. And they saw an extraordinary thing in the sky that night. They saw a smaller plane above Hammarskjöld's plane. Some people saw two smaller planes above Hammarskjöld's plane, and they saw a great light coming down from that smaller plane onto the bigger plane. And also there were reports that it blew up in the sky. But their testimony was discounted, disqualified, and was never taken seriously, which is really quite extraordinary because what an extraordinary thing to report. Some of the so-called European, which was the term used to mean white, in the Ndola community, also saw similar things in the sky, but they were discounted for different reasons. And this fits very closely and with the testimony of an American naval commander, Charles Southall, who was working for the NSA in Cyprus that night, who was brought in to the office unexpectedly just before midnight to hear something extraordinary. This had never happened to him before. And he heard a recording of a pilot shooting down Hammarskjöld's plane.
And we know that for sure.
Well, Commander Southall was very clear in his testimony. He did say he wasn't sure if he'd heard the recording or he'd read it. In some ways, to me, that makes it even more convincing because that's what memory is like after such a long time. But I checked his testimony out carefully again and again in all sorts of ways. And even where I was started off with initial doubts, it came through every time, and I believe him 100%.
So here is the Secretary General of the United Nations, the most powerful international body in the world. He's shot down in suspicious circumstances. He dies, and then nothing really happens. There was an investigation. It was inconclusive. That was run by the Northern Rhodesians, or by the Federation of Rhodesia, so North and South Zambia and what is now Zimbabwe.
Well, in fact, there were three investigations, just briefly to say that the first was a technical investigation, which did not exclude sabotage. The second was a Northern Rhodesian commission, which concluded that the cause of the death was pilot error, but it did not produce any evidence to support that. It claimed that it was pilot error on the elimination of other possible causes. Then the UN, which was working almost at the same time as the Rhodesian Commission, the UN Commission produced a report reaching an open verdict, saying it was impossible to know what happened and rejecting the Rhodesian conclusion of pilot error. And it was as a result of this UN report in 1962, that a resolution was passed by the UN saying that if new evidence were to emerge, then the UN Secretary General should ask the General Assembly to set up a new inquiry. There's a matter of justice here, I think, to all the people that died, to the pilots who were blamed for the crash, but also we can see now to individuals in very particular ways. The survivor of the crash was not taken to hospital until 3:15 in the afternoon following the crash that happened at midnight, which meant that he was lying in the blazing sun and very hot time of year in Zambia with injuries. He must have suffered terribly. But we now know for a fact, well, we have the evidence, that a whole range of high-level authorities, British, American, Rhodesian, knew that the plane had crashed. If not very early in the morning, shortly after the crash itself. So this is really shocking.
There are, as you point out in your book, all sorts of other ramifications. So, for instance, the Congo borders, I think it's 9 other African countries. It's a huge, huge place. And what happens in the Congo obviously impacts on the rest of the continent. Since that time, there has been huge instability there. Also, looking further to the south of the continent, Rhodesia, as you say, had a role in this. And I think that the fact that the United Nations under Hammarskjöld was looking at decolonisation had an enormous effect on Rhodesia. Of course they didn't want that to happen. The Rhodesians were desperate to cling on to power. I think that if Hammarskjöld had not died, it would have had an enormous impact on the future of Rhodesia. The senseless civil war that happened there, the amount of deaths that took place, the impact indeed on my very own family would have been completely different. And so, as you say, the effect of this crash was so far-reaching. Now, that resolution left it open that if there was new evidence, as you said, it could be revisited. Well, a lot of that new evidence has come from you. And now the UN, as a result, in part of your fantastic book, has decided to open it again.
Well, after my book came out, a group of the great and good of the world, if you like, the former Commonwealth Secretary General, two members of the House of Lords here in the UK, the former Archbishop of Sweden, set up a trust which in turn set up what they called the Hammarskjöld Commission, which was for international jurists of the highest calibre and standing who looked into the evidence that was available at that time. They produced a report at the Peace Palace in The Hague in 2013 that recommending strongly that the UN take this forward because there was new evidence. A resolution was passed in the General Assembly that was unanimous, backing the opening up of the inquiry into Hammarskjöld, which was really extraordinary. And then Ban Ki-moon, UN Secretary General, set up a UN panel of experts chaired by Chief Justice Ottman of Tanzania. And they produced a report in 2015, last year, strongly recommending that this be investigated further. And Ban Ki-moon, when he made this report public, attached a statement by himself, which is incredibly moving, referring to the fact that there was important evidence of aerial attack or other interference, of the fact that it appears that the cryptographic machine used on Hammarskjöld's plane had been intercepted, a range of evidence, and this should be looked into further. And he said it was a solemn duty that we should find out what in fact happened to Hammarskjöld and the 15 others.
And have we?
At the moment, following the release of that report, the UN is setting up a central archive of material related to Hammarskjöld's death, which is very exciting. But one of the problems which Ban Ki-moon identified very clearly in his letter attached to the panel's report was that we need documents from member states, and member states are not, in fact, delivering the documents as required. So, for example, in the case of the UK, the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, when asked to provide all relevant documentation, responded by saying they had consulted across all relevant departments and there was no new documentation to furnish. It seems reasonable to assume, and this is my view, that they did not include the security and intelligence agencies because, of course, they weren't relevant because they're exempt from freedom of information. And I know that there is material relating to the intelligence agencies because, for example, I found a report by an MI6 officer who was in Indola at the time and involved in all sorts of things in a private archive. Well, if that exists in a private archive, then I'm sure there's a copy in the MI6 records, and it cannot be an orphan. There's obviously a whole lot more. And there are a range of other strong indications that the security and intelligence agencies have a lot of material relating to this, which, of course, they're not delivering. So it's going to be very hard for Ban Ki-moon's strong wish that our member states deliver all relevant documentation for this to come to fruition.
Mm. Now, he's also said that whoever takes over from him as UN Secretary General must say that they will go ahead with this, that they will absolutely support this investigation, because it's clear there has been some kind of cover-up.
The cover-up is clear. What's more difficult is to work out who did what. But the fact of the cover-up is the evidence is there. And I would argue that even without knowing all the details about who did what at the time, because we know about this cover-up and because we know, for example, that survivor was in the blazing sun until 3:15 in the afternoon, some kind of apology is owed. Some kind of, not compensation is the wrong thing, but this should be set right.
Now, the tremendous amount of research that you did for this book led to another fascinating story, which you've documented in your most recent book, Spies in the Congo, The Race for the Ore That Built the Atomic Bomb. How did Hammarskjöld lead you to that story?
When I was working on the Hammarskjöld research, I was surprised by how many spies there were in Leopoldville, now Kinshasa, and other parts of Congo. And when I discussed it with people, they all, you know, read literature on this. The view was, oh, well, this was just a flash because of the Cold War. But it didn't seem right that there could suddenly be this infrastructure, and also the level of American infrastructure in Congo at that time seemed to me very surprising. It couldn't just suddenly happen. So I started to look back, and I saw that in the 50s, it was the same thing. And there was growing role of spies and also of American infrastructure and the building of a huge airfield at Kamina. Why? And then I just kept on going further back. And then I went back to the Second World War, and I found that that's when it started. US had almost nothing to do with Congo before the Second World War.
So there was clearly huge American interest in the Congo. Now, this was all sparked by a letter from Albert Einstein. What did he say?
Yes. Well, he signed a letter which had been put together by colleagues, physicists, which they sent to President Roosevelt, warning of the risk that Germany might be building an atomic bomb. Now, that letter is very well known, but it's usually understood as being about the risk of physicists and German physicists building a bomb, the focus being on the physics. But actually, if you look closely at that letter, the focus is really on the fact that there was remarkable uranium in the Belgian Congo, as the Congo was then, and America should try to ensure control of that uranium.
Which is exactly what they did, and hence
exactly
the huge US presence in the Congo.
Absolutely. I think one aspect of that that some people find surprising is how miraculously rich this uranium was. On average, it had 65% uranium oxide. It could assay up to 75% in comparison with American and Canadian uranium ore, which contained less than 1%. It's dramatic.
Now, in order for the Americans to ensure the safe passage of the uranium out of the Belgian Congo and back to America for it to be part of the Manhattan Project, they sent in the Office of Strategic Services, sent in a number of spies who would do this. And your wonderful book, which really does read like a thriller, explains all this to us. And it focuses on a few particular characters. And I'd like us to talk about Doc Hogue. He was a spy who was sent out there. I love your wonderful description of him packing his sharkskin dinner jacket and so on, and going out to the Congo. What was his role?
His role was to protect the transit of the ore to the port en route to the US, and also to prevent smuggling to Germany. This was, as you suggested, very much part of the determination to ensure that Germany did not get hold of this uranium ore. One of the things that was great for me writing this book is I grew to like my spies so much. And Hogue was very different from the other OSS spies who mostly came from Ivy League and privileged backgrounds. And he came from a background where people were really struggling. And he had a very strong sense of duty and obligation. And he looked after the people under him very loyally. He stood up for them in relation to headquarters in Washington. Very nice person. And he also had a woman working for him who was another incredibly nice person. Her code name was Angela, and she really was quite an angel. Plain looking, but with a very strong sense of adventure. And she had, unusual for women at that time, she'd gone from the US to Central Africa to fight fascism.
Amazing. Her name was Shirley Chidsey, and
yeah,
she is, in fact, the only woman really involved in this story. Now, it was so secret. This project was so secret. Even the spies themselves didn't know what the ore was for, did they?
No. I suspect one of them knew more than the others, but certainly none of them had been told the purpose of the ore. They just did what they were told to do. I think it's important also to bear in mind that, really, the secrecy about the Manhattan Project was across the board, and even President Truman, when he became president after the death of Roosevelt in April 1945, he didn't know about the Manhattan Project. He had to be told. Mm. Only six members of the US Army knew of the project. And of course, there were thousands of people working in it, but they were all working in compartments, and the compartments didn't know what the other compartments were doing. So it was very carefully kept a secret.
Mm. I know that in the US, they sent spies into libraries to make sure that there was equal wear on the library books and not just at the parts that dealt with uranium and what it could be used for. Crucially, though, the thousands of miners and other people on the ground who were handling this didn't know of its radioactive properties.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. Coming back to the spies, they died very young, and one of them died at the age of 38, one of them, Hoag, died at 42, and they died of sicknesses that are associated with exposure to radiation. And when one thinks about the goodness knows how many people who were working in the mines or transporting the uranium in Congo, it's pretty horrifying to think that they had almost no health and safety protection whatsoever.
Now, we know what this led to. We all know what happened in August 1945 and the huge loss of life that followed the atomic bombs made with Congolese ore. And you've just been to South Africa for the 71st anniversary of the atomic bombs. And this is really important because it's Africa and the Congo acknowledging that link.
Well, there is a group of Congolese in Cape Town, who are very conscious of the impact of the Shinkalobwe mine, the uranium mine in Katanga, and how its use in the Manhattan Project has impacted on their community and on their lives. Many members of this community come from the area near the mine, and they held a meeting to remember what had happened and to put a spotlight on it. And it was this was held on Hiroshima Day just a couple of weeks ago. And it was very profoundly moving to listen to people talk about what this had meant to them. One woman talked about the suffering of her grandfather, who had a piece of brain growing through his mouth. When somebody referred to genetic deformities that go through the generations, people were nodding with such sadness. And of course, this just isn't recorded anywhere. And if you bear in mind that some remains of the Shinkalobwe ore in the US has caused concern to Americans in that area, understandably. But a budget of $500,000 annually has been put to help protect people from the radiation associated with those remains. It seems extraordinary and so unjust that nothing has been done for the people who have suffered in Katanga, in Congo, as a result of the radiation they've been exposed to, that whole area has been exposed to. And the UN-led investigation just over 10 years ago found that the whole area is really dangerous to health and safety to be there.
There are so many avenues that we could pursue about this. We could be talking about the state of the mines now. Of course, they're flooded, mm-hmm. but the security there is very, very bad.
Well, the mine is closed, but freelance miners still go there because life is so difficult and they need to earn a living. A terrible threat to their health.
And there's a worry about who that ore might be being sold to.
Absolutely. That's a very good point.
Before we go, I want to touch on one of your earlier books, and that's The Colour Bar. It's about the founding president of Botswana, Sir Seretse Khama, and his cross-racial marriage to Ruth Williams. It's a wonderful book, and really excitingly, it's just been made into a film called A United Kingdom. So tell us about that.
The story of Seretse Khama, in some ways, has some connection with the story of Dag Hammarskjöld, I think, because Seretse Khama was like Dag Hammarskjöld. They both came from patrician backgrounds. They both had a strong sense of duty, integrity, obligation, and responsibility for the larger community. And people like that are very compelling. And for his life and work to be translated into this film is so exciting, because then people will be able to see these values exemplified in a way that is very meaningful. And there are some aspects of the story where Seretse Khama reaches reconciliation with his uncle Shekhedi Karma. It's a complicated story. I won't go into that now. But there is a moment where they put aside their conflicts for the sake of the people of what was then Bechuanaland, now Botswana, in order to resist the machinations of the British and in order to protect their country. And it offers an incredibly moving example of the possibility of coming together, of not having conflict, which I think we can all learn from. One aspect of the story of Botswana that is extremely interesting is that, unlike many other countries in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and we've just been talking about the Congo, Botswana, during independence, was seen to have very little in the way of minerals. It was just semi-desert, and it was considered just semi-desert. And it was only around the time of independence that diamonds were discovered, which of course have transformed Botswana. And people in Botswana say they thank God for the fact that the British never knew, and other potential European colonizers did not know about these diamonds, which meant that Botswana was very likely colonized.
Tell me, who stars in the movie?
Well, David Oyelowo, who is the most wonderful Seretse Khama. And seeing him on set, I just went up and said, Seretse, it's so good to see you. I couldn't help it. Rosamund Pike, a marvellous Ruth Khama. And of course, the director, Amma Asante, she's done a tremendous job with this. And her values are in the film. And this is when I have seen versions of the film, I have been so delighted. It's been such a privilege to see and to be involved with. She's directed the most wonderful, moving film that I think is also going to help transform the way many people look at Africa and the history of Africa. It's just such a wonderful film.
And people will be able to see it because it's at the Toronto International Film Festival. It opens the London International Film Festival, and then it'll be on general release. A United Kingdom is the name of that. It's based on your book, The Calabar, Spies in the Congo and Who Killed Doug Hammarskjöld, published by Hearst. The Calabar will be re-released to coincide with the film, and many thanks to their author, Susan Williams.
Thank you, Georgina.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to sound engineer Sam Impey and editor Tony Hammond. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website, our app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks for listening.